This is Janet McKean from Caro, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, hands-on radio.
You are invited to join me upon the Cypress Bough. Music from North Africa, West and Central Asia. First Monday of every month, 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM. And WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by The Highway Drive-In, a four-screen drive-in movie theater in Coxsackie, New York. Information and schedule at HIWAYDriveIn.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Janine of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Meant to Ferment on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Meant to Ferment on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. My name is Rebecca Echevarria, and I will be your host for this show. This show explores the fermentation world of the Hudson Valley through interviews with practitioners and a bit of music inspired by their work. Today, I am super grateful to have Dr. Gabriel Perron to the show. Dr. Perron is an associate professor of biology at Bard, visiting researcher at NYU, and visiting researcher at the New York Genome Center. Though his research interests began and still explore antibiotic resistance, he has published multiple papers focused on fermentation in the last several years, including papers on the impact of water chlorination on sourdough starters, the microbial terroir of fermented foods, and the genomic strains of a bacteria found in kimchi. In collaboration with the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture, he is currently and just recently published a paper investigating how fermenting with post-frost cabbage and carrots influences their probiotic diversity and nutrient quality. I actually met Dr. Perron briefly while working as an apprentice on Sky High Farm. He was collecting soil samples for a study on the microbiome of different soils. So it's really fascinating work all around. I am very excited to have him on the show, and thank you so much for being here. But before we chat, I have a few songs inspired by your work. I really enjoyed exploring the music for this show. Right now, beneath me, we are listening to Riley McLaughlin's Molecular Meditation Hin D3 from their 1990 album DNA Music. Riley makes music translated from the DNA molecule. He assigns musical notes to the four bases of DNA, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, and thus created pieces based on DNA sequences. To create this music, Riley worked with Dr. David Diemer, a professor at UC Davis who studies DNA. But Dr. Perron, I'm sure you're much more knowledgeable about DNA than I am, and we'll be getting into it in a bit. Have you ever heard DNA music before?
Actually, I did. And a friend of mine is trying to put into music fermentation, microbial communities too.
That's amazing. Wonderful. Well, this is another musician to explore as well. I can't wait to hear that. But soon, we're going to enter Paul Shaw and David Rogers' song Breakthrough from their album Science and Technology. And we'll see you on the other side of this one. We're back. So that was Breakthrough, Paul Shaw and David Rogers' song from their album Science and Technology, also made in the same year as Molecular Meditation. So maybe there was some microbial energy happening at that time. Yeah, and a lot of the songs refer to scientific work, microbes, data stream, experiment, let's discover. And I particularly like this one, and we'll be talking about Dr. Perrone's breakthroughs in a little bit. But next, we have Diane Oxner's 1957 The Sauerkraut Song from the album Diane Oxner Sings the Helen Creighton Collection of Traditional Folk Songs of Nova Scotia. Do you enjoy sauerkraut generally as a ferment?
Yeah, very much so. Yep.
Me too. And I assume Diane Oxner did as well. So we'll be hearing her soon.
Sauerkraut. The crowd is not made of leather, as everyone supposes, but of that little plant what they call the cabbage roses. Sauerkraut is bully, I told you it is fine. Methinks me ought to know him, for me eats them all the time. The cabbages are growing so nice as it can be. Me take them out and cut them up, the bigger as a pea. Me put them in a barrel and me stamp with me feet. And me stamp for to make them nice and sweet. Sauerkraut is bully, I told you it is fine. Me thinks me ought to know them, for me eats them all the time. Me put in plenty of salt so nice, don't put in no snuff, nor any cayenne pepper or any of that stuff. Me put him in the cellar till she begins to smell, so help me twice, me think it nice, the Dutchman like it well. Sauerkraut is bully, I told you it is fine, me thinks me ought to know him, for me eats them all the time. Now when the sauerkraut begins to smell, and it can't smell no smeller, me take him from the barrel that's way down in the cellar. Me put him in the kettle till she begins to bile, so help me, you can smell around for 40,000 mile. Sauerkraut is bully, I told you it is fine, me thinks me ought to know him, for me eats them all the time.
And we're back with Dr. Perrone, an assistant professor in biology at Bard.
That's
right. Did I get that right? Okay, good. And I picked that song because you just released a study on sauerkraut and also carrots in collaboration with Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture, which we'll be getting into in a bit. Mm-hmm. But I like to start off my shows with what the word fermentation means to you and how you define fermentation and or.
We're starting with the most difficult question. I guess there's a technical definition that I think I try sometimes, especially in a maybe like in a class setup, to try to focus on. It's usually the absence of oxygen, and we have microbes that basically will have to use a different way to get energy out of the nutrients. But I'm also happy sometimes just to kind of accept alternative or maybe a broader definition for food practitioners, as long as it doesn't interfere with what they're trying to do. But I like the idea of fermentation just because I use it at a personal level too, like, oh, I need to ferment on this or incubate on this, like thinking about slowly, like letting time sink in and do its work before I make a decision. So I like the metaphor of fermentation anyway.
I mean, I think about ferments as almost containers of time, but I don't think I've ever thought about it almost as like an active state that you can kind of be fermenting also in your, like what you just said, in your thought processes or different reflections. Yeah, it can be a kind of teacher in that way.
I think it maybe is the microbiologist perspective yeah. versus the humanist, just because, you know, there's a lot going on. Whilst for us, it's a pause, like you start the fermentation and you wait for 20 days or whatnot. But from the microbiology perspective, that's like the first 5 or 6 days, this is where there's the most stuff going on too. So that's where I guess for me, it's like it doesn't mean you're just taking a rest or waiting. There's a lot going on.
It's active.
It's very active. Yes, very much so.
But I love, how you brought in both the scientific and the humanistic, because that is, I mean, kind of how it usually takes place, a combination of the two. But speaking of that, in terms of your own fermentation, since your research was initially focused on pathogenic bacteria found in the environment and how they contribute to antibiotic resistance, I was wondering about your personal journey mm-hmm. and how fermentation came to enter as a research interest in your work.
I tend to go with
another
too long. Stories are too long. No, it's great. I think so. Basically, I've always been into food. And an uncle of mine who was a former priest introduced me to fancy cheese. It was a priest until he met my aunt. Anyway.
Story for another time.
He introduced me to fancy cheese. And Quebec has if you picked up on the accent, I'm a French Canadian. I'm from Quebec. And we have a pretty big cheese culture there. So I got very interested. But I kept on the distance. My research, as you said, was mostly on pathogenic bacteria. That means that I was studying things you don't want in your food. And then when I came to Bard College, I realized that I would be mostly working with undergraduates, still in training, very much so. And I decided that working with Salmonella was not an option because I did not want to be known as Dr. Poop because you can get sick very quickly. Yeah. But in the meantime, I met a friend of mine who was a chef in Tivoli, Ray Peraza. Okay. The restaurant since then has closed, but we ended up like being friend and talking about how microbiology is important. It was always trying to do experiments in his own kitchen. So one day we just decided, let's work together. Let's do this. And I just started describing all the work that he was doing using microbiology tools. Then that just got us started. So now we had the tools. We had the interest. It was combining my love for food and science and an amazing friend who was just like super intellectually engaged. So that's how I got started about, 10 years ago, I guess.
And this was this the same person who you collaborated with on the 2022 study on microbial terroir?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
I see.
Yep.
Okay, mm-hmm. So your collaborations with them began much more time ago than study.
I guess when we started talking intellectually about fermentation, and he would, sometimes shoot me a text asking me, like, oh, what do you think about increasing the salt concentration to that level? Mm. Like, well, I don't think it's going to do what you think, what you're hoping for. So helping each other out a little bit that way. And then formalizing the collaboration, maybe 5 years after we started talking to each other.
So it came from more of a relational standpoint and then kind of formalized into these studies or these more research papers.
I mean, as a scientist, I like to get, basically this kind of work for me has been very meaningful because I try to let farmers or chef define the questions. So it comes, to go back to your introduction a little bit, it comes almost more from a humanity point of view, like a human perspective in a question. Mm. And I let that define the scientific questions. And my role now is not to define the questions, this is what we should be working on, is what do you have in mind? What are you working on these days? And I translate that into a scientific question. It takes a little longer because not always, doing science in a professional kitchen is, chefs are basically scientists, but not like scientific method, right? So translation takes a little more time in terms of let's have replicates. Let's repeat that 3 times. Like, why? So it takes a little longer to get started.
Yeah, the processes are different and the time scales as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
But that's interesting to hear that's how it all began. I mean, how has the field kind of evolved since that initial beginnings? Because I know people are always talking about, fermentation is, the hot new thing or is becoming getting increasingly popular, but from a research standpoint, what has been your experience in seeing it evolve since that initial conversation with your friend?
That's such an interesting question. So, I mean, my friend kind of got me into fermentation before the hype was really there. He's always he's one of those big nerds that just dig into anything and any kind of new cooking technique he can use, he will. So it's interesting because I was made aware of it before the trend really started.
Okay.
So I was able to kind of keep track of it. I'd say there was a hype. Scientifically speaking, around 2010, 2015, there's a few scientific papers that came out of the Harvard Food Lab.
Okay.
I think.
And they have a course as well, right?
Exactly.
Like an
I can't
course.
Remember exactly the name, but there's an online course. It's a course that became very popular, and 2 researchers there, while I was there for a few years, started to explore cheese and other fermented products. And the idea of using it as a small microcosm, right? So instead of using a test tube, you can kind of use this as, it's as you said a little before, it's a little world in itself.
Yeah.
It's not just an isolate bacteria. You can study communities. I didn't see that taking off that much as we thought. But at the first fermentation conference, Stanford, in September, it looks like it would be interesting to see like where the field is. I think it might be the first snapshot of like, oh, who's working on this? How many people? What's the state of the field now? So that would be super interesting.
I'll be attending that virtually, but
me too,
I'm sure. Okay. It would be amazing for those who are able to be in person to learn from each other. And from a practitioner standpoint, there does seem to be this breadth of work being produced in all over the world. Across the spectrum, kind of across disciplines, not specifically only microbiology, but incorporating fermentation into different studies, in different spaces. Going back to that microbial terroir study, like you just mentioned, you can kind of reveal communities. That was really interesting to me to see because this study is looking at the microbial terroir, which, if you aren't familiar, is the microbial diversity that's specific to a place. I had never heard of that term before your paper. You are examining fermented food products made in your friend's restaurant's kitchen and seeing the bacterial communities that are there. So I really enjoyed reading that. A lot came out of it.
Yeah, I actually, you know what? I was surprised because my take on this is like, well, everything we're going to find in your food was probably going to be from the kitchen that you're working from.
Okay, and more of the ambient environment.
Or the ambient environment, right? Okay. Like what's in, and you've been fermenting for quite some time. Therefore, you're probably cultivating the right kind of bacteria in the environment. There's those kind of legendary studies in Belgium, like breweries moving to a new place and they fail to do their sour beer
until
they move a wooden beam and then it starts again, right? So the environment clearly plays a big role. But the surprise was to actually find out that, I mean, it doesn't make that, it's not that surprising after all.
You don't need centuries old.
Well, basically, the cabbage fermented as cabbage and the carrots fermented as carrots. And they were like closer to like microbial communities you would find in Korea, for example, ones that were made from carrots just next door, right? So cabbage from here were a little bit more closer in composition or in communities than cabbages in papers that we saw from Korea. That means that the product itself, the vegetables or the fruits you use, play a big role. And that was really cool. You know, we thought that the hands, the environment would play a much bigger role than that. But still, we were able to find small differences that still shows that the place you are in matters.
Did you come across different studies from around the world because, you know, this is in one specific place at a time. I just wonder what the other, maybe they would come to the same conclusion that it's the ingredients are possibly the main driver of what bacterial communities show up in fermented foods.
Yeah, I mean, not directly testing that. Looking at the different literature, you can see that actually it makes sense and it plays a big role. One of the biggest studies trying to look at differences between location. I mean, wine has been, in California, has been well studied. Those are the people who introduced the term microbial terroir, or at least like made it more popular as a field of study. And people working on sourdough, asking people to send their sourdough starter from around the world and starting to look at the differences. But then it's usually the same, or at least fairly much the same ingredients. And then that's really more looking about the opposite, right? Like how much from the environment comes from in sourdough.
And kind of transmute into the product itself. Yeah. So interesting. I mean, one of the things that I really caught my eye when looking at that study was the spruce. Had the highest microbial diversity, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
Just because I had an amazing forager on the show, Tanya Himeji Romero, forager, but also many other things in her practice. And just considering like the microbial diversity that is happening in wild foods and these foods that we probably did at certain points in humanity we're consuming in a much higher frequency. So seeing that compared to like the vegetables or different or the legumes, caught my eye.
Yeah, I mean, to me it was the start of a reflection also on the origin of the products that we see as fermented food more often. So with the project we did at Stone Barns, which was, again, using cabbages and carrots, we see a lot more divergence in carrots. But to go back to these projects, to me, so maybe cabbages are more often fermented. Many cultures have discovered the beauty of fermented cabbages. Questions to me then is like, is that why they're the fermented one? Because it works. The vegetable itself seems to host a microbial diversity that leads to successful, more reliable fermentations. And if your livelihood depends on it for food, right, it makes a lot of sense. Whilst carrots is not something most people think about as a fermented product, although if you haven't, please try it. That's what made me fall in love with fermented product, actually.
Oh, yeah?
But
what kind of fermented
carrots? Lacto-fermented carrots. Put a little bit of carrots. You put 4% of salt, and then you just let it do its magic. And it's just so sweet and delightful. And as my friend would say, it's like a way to basically carry the fall harvest all the way through December or March when you actually open that bottle and just like use it for a carrot cake or just as a condiment or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever made a lacto-ferment. I mean, I do love making pickles with carrots. I don't know why. Maybe I've incorporated it into sauerkraut before, like as a combo, but yeah, not so much carrots happening in my lacto-ferments.
I would definitely give it a try. But
now, yeah.
But it's a little bit less reliable. Do a few batches. One might not turn out as good. The microbial diversity is a little less predictable. And going back to the spruce, many of us now have read these studies, or Sean Sherman in his presentations will very often comment on the number of different plant species, indigenous or Native Americans, would actually eat just not that long ago. And now, you know, like on average, I think people consume 20 different species on average a year, right?
Yeah.
And what you say is so accurate, right? It's not just about eating probiotic or prebiotic the way people like try to market it now. Bridging a diversity of ingredients clearly it brings a different kind of diversity as well, right? Like just the spruce has so much to offer, really brings something different to your diet.
And something that we wouldn't necessarily expect. So you had that study in 2022, you had another study on sourdough, and your recent study that just came out on cabbage, again, on cabbage and carrots also. Yeah, they're both
being, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about this study?
Yeah, so this is a fun collaboration that happened with the amazing staff and group and leaders at Stone Barns. And again, it's one of those examples where it's a question that comes from the practitioners, and they felt that their sauerkraut and carrots, fermented carrots, but mostly the sauerkraut was just more delicious after it was exposed to frost. The idea here is to try to define maybe like what's unique about the Northeast, something that would set them apart. Like why would you buy cabbage from the Northeast or not from California or other parts of the world? And then they find that it was more delicious once it was frosted. I think it's kind of a common knowledge, right? I think a lot of people know that maybe vegetables are a little sweeter after they've been exposed to frost. It breaks down the cell wall, it makes the sugar more available, so you just taste it, right? But then from the fermentation point of view, it was interesting to see like what actually happened. They ask us, could you help us figure it out? So we designed this experiment, and they were super willing to actually kind of follow an experimental design while separating the farm and using the crops in their restaurant at Blue Hill after that. But what we found, basically, like, it's one of those classic examples that I can't wait to teach to students, because in science is an obsession to finding something. Oh, I found
novel,
this amazing
novelty,
difference, a novelty.
Yes, yes.
So I was like, well, this is a cool project, because all we want to know here is that there's no difference, because we don't want to find that. I mean, ideally, we don't want frost to show that it's less good for you,
okay,
or that it kills all the probiotics. And then, maybe you should not do that as a sauerkraut kind of rebranding, or like just like having a new finding. I was expecting to find no differences, and what we found is actually that it really seems to bolster like the probiotic diversity, make it more reliable. Even more surprisingly, we look at 5 vitamins, and there was a change, it was actually higher in cabbage that were exposed to frost and then fermented for 20 days. So we saw an increase in vitamin K1 and a few other things, but this was surprising to me. This is really cool, because now they have a product that they feel is tastier and that they're happy to serve to their people. They also have a product that seems to be healthier, right? We're not doing clinical trial here to confirm that it's healthier. I mean, it's more based on like our understanding of the literature, and when you have more vitamin, it's pretty intuitive that it should at least represent a better source of nutrients. So we got pretty excited by those results.
With results about the impact on nutrient quality, I thought I had read there is a balance of, did the frost impact the nutrient quality, or was it the time that the product was fermented for?
Absolutely. So that's a very good point, and you're a good reader. You're a good student.
I do my research. Yeah.
So basically what we found is that, so again, right, to me, this is what the important is to work with the practitioner. They were like, but we're not fermenting things for exactly the same number of days, because the frosted cabbage fermented a little faster. So they stopped it because they were like, it's ready for consumption as far as we know. And I'm like, well, look, it does sound like a poor experimental design, because you're not doing the same number of days. But what matters is that when are you going to serve that for food. Because mm-hmm. that's the point here. But you're trying to feed people. So it's irrelevant the number of days. It's important to keep track of. And now we repeated the experiment last year with the same number of days to try to like understand exactly where it happens, find the mechanisms behind all of this. But as a starting point, what matters is when you want to feed people. It's so interesting intellectually to ask the practitioner, what is it that we're doing here? When are you going to use it? How are you going to use it? That's what we need to like know. And that's what we need to describe. So you're really setting out the design. And that's what makes it, to me, the change of days is not that important.
Yeah.
Because it will serve this. Therefore, it will serve something that has more vitamins.
So looking at how to balance all those different kind of conditions, because when you're in the restaurant, that the timing becomes critical. Or, I mean, you can slow it down, but still that will could impact the flavors out.
Absolutely. And to me, that's why it's been so fun when like practitioners will ask me, oh, what do you want to do? Or what do you want me to do? Or when should I stop it? I'm like, when do you want to stop it? Or when would you stop it normally? I think they give me the authority to decide on the design. But then I like to reverse that and say, no, you're the authority here. And I'll tell you if I feel scientifically we can still justify it.
And then I'll
tell you no, or let's reassess if it's not going to fit from a scientific design point of view. So I really enjoyed that reversal. Then like, who has the power to design the experiment in some ways?
It's amazing to be able to, as a scientist, I would imagine, to bring in different disciplines in the structure, in the design of what you're both kind of hoping to achieve.
Yeah. When I get invited by people working in a different field, it's hard for me to say no. Do you do soil? Well, not until today, I guess. Now let's study soil. Don't want to basically like make things too simple. I mean, because people study soil for decades. Not an expert in everything I work on. I think that's the, and I think different approaches or the same approaches to different questions also give you sometimes a different perspective. Then you can integrate it with the practitioners, the field. You get to meet new people that can help you or question your methods, which is very fun because it keeps you on your toes.
Or come up with questions that maybe you didn't consider, ways of approaching something that could be different than what you're used to. So amazing to hear about that collaboration. And I was very lucky to read that study. Can't wait for listeners who are curious. It is available. You said it's available. It's been published and it's on.
So it's in the publishing process now. And it's something that I encourage everyone to look for. There's been a movement now to make science a lot more transparent. So it's called an archive or a preprint. So it hasn't been submitted for peer review yet, but it's the process that what you do before to basically like enable almost anyone to peer review it it gets actually peer reviewed by other experts. So it's publicly available on the BioArchive, and I'm sure, you know, if people want, they can reach out to you or me, and then I'm more than happy to share it.
No, it's very exciting. Yeah, congratulations. It must have been a big effort from you, lots of researchers.
We started the collaboration. Oh, it's going to be very small. And then it's going to be fast. And then, well, famous last words, right? But the results kept becoming more and more interesting. And each layer supporting the previous one. So it ended up like, okay, it's a full scientific project now taking a year in the making or more at this point. So it was very, very fun and satisfying to get that, to share that with the world at this point.
It's amazing. Really amazing work. I was curious to discuss one of the techniques that you actually used in this study, which is DNA sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
16S ribosomal RNA sequencing.
Yeah.
I did try to learn a little bit about DNA sequencing for this show. Oh, and if you're just tuning in, my name is Rebecca Echevarria. I'm here with Dr. Gabriel Perrone, an assistant professor of biology at Bard, speaking about his research and his use of DNA sequencing. I was wondering if you could explain DNA sequencing to a layperson like me. What is it and what are you hoping to find?
Yeah, so I hope that everyone is familiar with DNA. I think more and more people are since 1993, Jurassic Park. Thank you for...
Still going.
Still
going.
Well, let's go back to 1993 for the science.
It's a little dicey. That's the controversial topic of our show.
But basically, DNA is what some people like. We're in a food program, right? So let's talk. Basically, it's the cookbook, right? So DNA itself is a very stable, kind of not super active molecule that every cell in your body has. And that information is basically the blueprint that all life can use to basically start You know, when you have an embryo, then genes would start being activated. Genes are basically units that codes for information. There's a specific order, how much of ingredients you need. And then if you follow that recipe, you end up with a baby. It's still a wonder. When you start thinking about it, it's really amazing.
So wild. Yeah.
And bacteria have the same thing, right? They have this blueprint. So they also replicate. They have to basically recreate exactly everything they have so that each cell's will basically be able to be viable. What happens during fermentation, right? So you start with bacteria on the cabbage or the carrot, create an environment that will favor specific bacteria lactobacillus. Mm-hmm. So as they replicate their DNA. Reasons why DNA is important is that it needs to be relatively stable and not change so much so that the information is copied between one generation and the other, right? So bacteria from about 2 million years ago will have DNA that it's not so different that you could still kind of recognize it, actually. So now this gene that you talked about, 16S ribosomal RNA, is what we call a universal. So it's a gene so important that, as far as we know, bacteria has it.
Yes.
And if a bacteria does not have this gene, the bacteria cannot exist. So that means that that gene is in every bacteria and basically screen for it. And it's so important that it hasn't changed so much. So that means that over 2 million years, each species of bacteria or genus tends to not change that much. We can use the DNA sequence, so like the code that you talked about with the music earlier on, those four molecules, A, T, C, and G, each bacteria will have a unique signature of A, T, C, and Gs. So by reading that code, we can basically start saying, okay, in that mixture, in that fermented cabbage, I'm going to look at all the genes that I can find. Then we read that code, and then we can basically tell who was there.
And in that process, what also stuck out to me was that you're looking at this specific region within the bacteria that has more variety than other regions. And that helps you distinguish when you're doing that cross comparison to understand, oh, who's here, you know, what bacterial community has showed up, right?
Yeah. So you're really picking out on like a nuance that really enabled that the field to kind of emerge like in the past 10 years. So that gene I told you about, that universal gene, there's a section of it that you can't change. If a mutation happened between generations, the bacteria basically won't survive or won't be able to grow very much. Within that gene, there are what we call hypervariable regions. So these regions can change freely without affecting their livelihood. So basically, every time a bacteria replicate, or you know, everyone has a different genome, pretty much, right? So there's always little variabilities. So that's exactly this variability in that region that we screen. That's exactly what enables us to find differences, right? So a lactobacillus, which I think most people listening to this show would probably have heard of, leuconostoc, which is another bacteria, kind of not so different, a lactic acid bacteria. We can differentiate between those two important bacteria using that variability.
That variable region. Exactly okay, what you're saying. That kind of understanding has only arisen in the last 10 years or before.
So I would say it's twofold. So the person who kind of discovered this idea was in the 70s, and that was kind of that enabled the discovery of a completely different group of microbes, the archaea bacteria or archaea that we call now, which is something that I think the fermentation world is starting to look at a little bit too. But it's this knowledge with new technologies that made it more possible in the past 10 years. Because for a long time, it was a very long process. So you have to grow the bacteria, look at each of them individually. Now we can just kind of study, we can basically skip that step where we can study whole population at once, speeding up everything.
This is the method that you're using in the majority of your studies with both fermented foods and pathogenic, or is it kind of cross-discipline or cross-themes?
Yeah, so that technique, let's call it amplicon sequence. Yeah, I mean, so that technique, I would say, was refined in clinical trials to study gut microbiome. And the medical field getting interested in this really helped, like, speed up the technology, the methods that we study for the analysis. But then you can use the same technique to study soil microbiome, fermented microbiome as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the gut microbiome had such an impact on what tools are available. With the DNA sequencing, just for folks at home, because I recently got a microscope to be able to see the microbes that are present in my ferments that I'm making at home, I came across a video about DNA sequencing that mentioned a mobile DNA sequencer. I was interested any kind of community science efforts in these fields that you might be aware of?
I mean, with the microscope, it's really cool, right? I mean, for you'll be able to look at the shape of microbes. There's usually kind of four shapes. And fermented food, a lot of the stuff you should see will be kind of like mini sausages. yeah. They're not, in case you don't want to eat food product. We call them bacilli. So those are lactobacilli, lacunesta. They should be that size. As far as the DNA, yes, they are portable solutions. But I would just say that they're still, not that they're not reliable, but they're not that straightforward to work on. The truth is that usually the most challenging part is the analysis. You know, you would just have to kind of learn a little bit more how you analyze it. And there's not a lot of platforms yet where you could just go online and download your data and it gives you the information. But some foundations are getting there. I'm not going to name them just yet because we still have to trial them out a little bit. But that would be something we could maybe even organize, maybe a workshop or something like this. I could try it out in my class and see how successful we are.
After you kind of determine or you're identifying what bacteria are present, you have to cross compare it with all these databases. That might be a hurdle for community scientists to have access to these like grand swaths of bacterial data.
There's a lot. I mean, you know, the scientific community is wonderful and there's a lot of publicly available resources. Like everything I use is open access.
Okay.
Like I try to never use things that are proprietary or behind a paywall that you can't use. So I know that all the tools that I use are available. It's just, it takes the training to be able to make sense of the data. That's why I'm also an educator, right? So I believe in the power of learning and then be able to use that knowledge. So it would be an interesting like experiment to give it a try.
Totally. I'd be very excited about that. But you also just mentioned your class. So you could teach a class on food and microbiology, correct?
Yeah, so basically I've been teaching food and first it was food microbiology, then it became food and microbiology.
Okay.
And now I don't even know what it's called. It's like food. We basically use food.
Food, period.
Food, period, as a medium to learn about the human experience. Because I'm a scientist, I like to bring a lot of the scientific element, but they kind of emerge from questions. We've done cheese, we've done cider, we've done sourdough bread, we can also do kombucha. So through these experiences, we end up learning a lot about science. It's a course for non-majors, so it's taught for people with very little or almost no experience with the sciences or lab sciences, but we can fly pretty high using the power of food as like the driver for motivation to get to answer those questions.
Sounds like such a fun course.
I have a good time because I try to basically like bring the students to field sites. Like, oh, let's go visit a cidery. Let's go visit a cheesemaker. It's been very fun.
Yeah, because there's a lot going on around here.
Lot going on in the beautiful Hudson Valley.
In terms of fermentation, for sure.
I would say the Hudson Valley is a microcosm of what's going on globally. Some people fermenting with different technique and different expertise and different level in the small corners. It's been very fun.
So beautiful to be able to see the vast spectrum of approaches and interpretations of fermented food and drink. And how has the student interest been? Has there been kind of a growing student interest in this topic and these courses?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's just say that it's maybe the most stressful time of the year is to decide or find a way who can get in, because then I get a lot of students who really want to be in that class, and I wish we could just like the student interest is there, and I can tell the knowledge that people bring with them in this classroom for 10 years is astonishing.
Like the initial knowledge. What they're coming in, kind of the base.
Absolutely. So one of the first thing I always ask to students is, what are the essential nutrients? People always forgot water, pretty important. Or even naming naming fat or sugar. You need them to live. And then I ask them, what are the essential nutrients for bacteria? It's exactly the same, right? It's just maybe sugar looks differently for a bacteria. Glucose for us, it might be lactose for a bacteria. These are sugars, right, that they need for energy. So I feel like 10 years later, students come with a much better understanding of what they put in their mouth, how important it is for their health and their well-being. It's been really interesting to look at that as a teacher.
I wish the best of luck for all the students out there and for anyone who's maybe not even able to get into a course. Or there's so many resources online, and so many books being published and wonderful practitioners. I mean, I'm always eternally grateful to all these different practitioners who've impacted my practice and are enable me to keep learning and growing and making. And so that's a gift too.
And I want to say a gift is also having people like you or who care and want to do these things, because I've also been able to witness the trends and people coming, oh, what do you think about this? I'm like, I just wait 2 years and nobody's going to talk about it. And, you know, so students and people come with these preconception ideas as well. There's a lot of information, just as you said, but
true.
We need people
flip
like
side.
You that talk to experts who do research to try to parse things out. There's a lot of misinformation
sure,
out there.
Sure,
yeah. Or there's a lot of interest groups that are trying to move the direction of the discourse. Got to be careful.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different influences in the food system at large. It can be kind of murky. What's behind this motivation, or why is this being elevated above other things,
yeah,
or what
yeah,
is this,
yeah, yeah,
what's
yeah.
the, yeah, why is this being emphasized right now? And
you know, a word of advice, just like everything else, right, is just like, let's not jump on one study to make conclusions. I think science was never meant to be like this. It's supposed to be something we repeat, and we see people coming up with different evidences. Now, I think because of, for all sorts of reasons, like, I feel like one study can become like,
that
like
study,
the
one study,
study that explains if chocolate is good for you or not. I'm like, well, let's look at evidence as
more
over a few
nuanced.
Years.
Yes.
Before we make like, let's not start eating chocolate okay. every day just for that. So I think that's also another source for everyone just to feel, okay, that's good. This is fun. So let's wait another year or a few months and see what comes out before I start
so
to now like
eating chocolate
like
every
always
day.
Do the same thing, right? Just because it's almost impossible to disentangle food science with. And, I don't like this, like groups of interest. I think it's interesting that sometimes the private sector or other people will put the money to fund this research that otherwise maybe not be done. I think it doesn't disqualify science that's done by a group of interest necessarily, but it's important to be transparent. And then also that's why we need to accumulate more evidence. In that world where funding comes from different places, it's doubly important to actually just wait for more and more evidence to accumulate before
yeah.
we make a conclusion.
Well, I was so excited and happy to be able to read your research and talk to you about it today. Thank you so much again for being here. I wanted to ask if you had any upcoming news to share with listeners.
Yeah, we have. I think we're going to have a few things coming up. But yeah, we just had two new research. If you are a cider producer, we also have one on the microbial terroir of cider in the Hudson Valley.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
That we're very excited about. I think we're hoping that it's going to encourage more producers to start thinking more. Just more in depth about this. And if you're interested, just reach out. But also maybe some workshops coming up on either the impact of agriculture on water quality. These are things that we are interested in the labs. Look online for different presents. You might be able to find more information on things coming up.
Like you just mentioned, where can people find you if they're curious to learn more about your research, these projects?
Yeah, I would say look for my website on the BARD. So at GabrielPerron.com. I'm also associated to the Center for Humanities and Environmental Sciences at BARD. We also do a lot of events. This is like a powerful community-based science group, and they're doing very powerful stuff on water quality, hair quality, and more now food and land as well. So
wonderful. I wanted to ask if you had any words of wisdom or bits of advice for any fellow potential fermenters, perhaps even fermentation scientists, folks who are interested in taking their work to another level.
I think one thing, and that's what defines, I would say, what I do in my class, for example, is to not be intimidated by fermentation. I feel for a while there was maybe a little bit of a, maybe even coming from chefs sometimes, it's really hard. No, we've been,
yeah.
as a species, we've been doing this for a long time.
Long time.
And I think we have a lot of intuition and some good knowledge on how to get started. Give it a try. Then for practitioners, I would say reach out to a local scientist. I think some scientists, a lot of them are foodies or want to be foodies. They would love to get involved. You can even say, hey, we have a scientist at Bard College who did that with local chef. Like, could we do something similar? People are very excited to work with practitioners. And for scientists, I would say the same thing. Keep your eyes open and reach out. And when you go to a farm or a cidery or a restaurant, you see something interesting, ask questions, because you'll find fellow nerds that are very happy to share their knowledge and then basically learn from each other. For me, that's been the most impactful and most meaningful stuff I've been doing in the past 10 years, is to actually get to know and work and talk with practitioners. And I feel like I've learned so much, at least as much as I was able to help them learn some stuff about their own work. So it's been super exciting. So I would say, go ahead and do that, people.
Yeah, that's been my favorite thing of being a programmer on this station, WGXC, because I can nerd out with, you know, the subject or field that I'm super passionate about and speak to other people and get to learn, and then also kind of enter into other people's worlds where they're really nerding out. And it's just a really beautiful thing to be able to share that with one another. Well, again, thank you so much for being here. It was wonderful to speak with you. This is Meant to Ferment, and we will see you next time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You got tons of material and we really like your stuff. And do we have a genius on our hands? It's alright with me. I wouldn't change it.